I'm from Manhattan.
Auburn?
Buffalo.
Penyan. Who are we, New Yorkers?
I'm from a small town south of Syracuse, Lafayette, New York.
Montauk.
Saratoga Springs.
From Niagara Falls to Long Island, from the North Country to the Southern Tier, upstate, downstate, we are nearly 20 million. Half of us live in and around the global metropolis that is New York City. Half of us live in other cities and towns and amid the vast, beautiful rural landscapes of New York State. The concerns we New Yorkers voice about our lives and future are shared by Americans across the country. But New York is special. No other state in the nation has benefited as much from the global economy and suffered as much as has New York. From the bonuses, bailouts, and wealth on Wall Street to the remains of once mighty manufacturing industries in much of the rest of the state. This is our new reality. This is New York and the world. Our lives, our future. I'm Garrick Utley. Throughout this hour, we'll hear the stories of New Yorkers, young and old, urban and rural, all working to find the shape of their lives and their futures. And how did we get here? The story of New York begins with a tiny settlement perched precariously on an island.
Hi, I'm Rick Landman, and I live down in the southern tip of Manhattan for 33 years. And right now, we're standing at the corner of Wall Street, right across the street from the New York Stock Exchange and the Federal Building, and we're just looking southward down towards seeing all of what was New Amsterdam. And there was a wooden wall that was built right down the middle of the street, which was to keep out the British.
The wall disappeared, but the name stayed.
Correct.
Rick Landman is passionate about and guides visitors through the twisting streets and rich history of the old city.
This was not a religious utopian retreat. This was not for Puritans or pilgrims that wanted to live a more devout life. This was a corporation in Holland that decided, hey, we can make some money.
From the beginning, New Amsterdam, the future New York, was a global settlement. By 1640, the small company town had opened its doors to free trade and investment and diversity. 18 languages were spoken here. Today, you hear even more. For about three centuries, the New York business model for growth, jobs, and a better life worked beautifully for people in all parts of the state. Years ago, it was easy to shuffle off to Buffalo or to honeymoon at nearby Niagara Falls. Buffalo was the second busiest railroad hub in the nation after Chicago. The Erie Canal and then railroad lines crisscrossing the state brought industry, investment, jobs, and prosperity. Much of Albany was electrified before New York City. Buffalo was home to major manufacturers, each employing thousands of workers. Rochester was known as one of the nation's first boom towns. Binghamton was the original home of IBM. Doolang, doolang, doolang. Doolang, doolang. He's so fine. By 1963, 50 years ago, the soundtrack had changed, but the tune was still upbeat. When Governor Nelson Rockefeller gave his annual State of the State address, it rang with confidence.
We in this sovereign state of New York are an economically advanced and prospering people. This administration has set as its goal the stimulation of the greatest economic expansion in the state's history. 500,000 new jobs in the next 4 years.
Even then, Governor Rockefeller knew that the future lay in a growing global economy.
To advance this effort, I opened a Commerce Department office in Montreal last September, the first outside the country. A similar office will be opened this year in Europe.
That would be in Brussels, Belgium, the seat of the new European Common Market. A personal story. I am in Brussels in 1963, a young reporter for NBC News covering my first story, the opening of that very New York State Trade Office. Governor Rockefeller enters the room. He speaks of New York's vibrant economy and talented workforce and their attraction for European investors. And then, I vividly recall, he looks into the assembled television cameras and says, quote, New York, is open for business. Fast forward to Governor Andrew Cuomo.
When you look at the beautiful state seal, at the heart of the seal, in the middle of the shield, are two ships on the Hudson River. Those two ships were put there when the seal was designed to symbolize intracoastal and international commerce, that at the heart of this state is business. And we have to relearn the lesson our founders knew, and we have to put up a sign that says New York is open for business.
Same line, New York is open for business, but half a century later in a very different world. Back in 1963, few New Yorkers, even a Rockefeller as governor, understood what was coming. Yes, the world was knocking on New York's door, but not to invest and create jobs, rather to take them.
Pabst Blue Ribbon Beer presents Blue Ribbon Town, starring Groucho Marx with his special guest, Jack Benny.
In the mid-20th century, radio was still a mass medium of broadcasting. Utica was known as the radio manufacturing capital of the world. General Electric employed up to 8,000 workers there. And then the jobs vanished.
What's troubling about New York is that so much of the jobs in the state depended on the manufacturing sector.
In the 1960s, GE moved its manufacturing of radios to Asia. Entire industries and jobs would soon follow, to the Sun Belt, to Mexico, and Asia.
Three of the six major metro areas upstate had more than 40% of their jobs in manufacturing in 1975.
Which ones were those?
Syracuse, Buffalo, and Binghamton. Today, it's between 10 and 15% of their jobs in manufacturing.
Jonathan Bowles heads the Center for an Urban Future. He led the preparation of the report New York and the World, commissioned by the SUNY Levin Institute, a data-driven, in-depth study of the impact of the global economy on New York State.
It's been devastating. I think, the upstate economies are still trying to figure out what's their place in the global economy. What are the strategies to see, to get their economies rolling again? There have been increases in services jobs and retail, a lot of low-end jobs, but manufacturing really provided an outlet to the middle class for so many people in these communities.
My name is Thaddeus Crone. I've lived in Auburn 48 years. I'm 51 now. And right now I am unemployed. I just earned another degree from Cayuga Community College in electronics technology. I was a production technician, and the lines that I was covering, which was handheld computers, just started to migrate over to China. So right now I have 3 degrees, 2 associates and 1 bachelor's. And I'm looking for gainful employment using any of my degrees that I have. We're on food stamps, and we got assistance for the gas and electric bill, and I just really want to settle down and be established. I have a 2-year-old son, and I'd really like him to see the wonders of the Central New York area. But at this point, it's starting to look like, if things don't pick up, if companies aren't willing to invest in people, we may have to look somewhere else.
There are many examples throughout the state of manufacturers and workers who have found a place in the new economy, but not without sacrifice. Reporter Cecil Overgaard takes us to a GM plant just outside of Buffalo.
I'm at the GM powertrain plant in Tonawanda, and I'm taking a hike because they kindly asked me to park my foreign-made car a good 500 feet from the entrance. They're not messing around here.
You try to buy where you work. You try to buy where you live.
For Bob Coleman, there is nothing new or trendy in the philosophy of buy local. As a third-generation employee here at Tonawanda and the union shop chair, it's a way of life.
Well, both my daughters, they know that, I promote Buy American, and they know do not pull a foreign vehicle in our driveway.
There's something almost nostalgic about that sentiment and about the recently implemented parking lot of shame out there. And yet, while Coleman would never be caught dead owning a Nissan
or a
Toyota or anything like that, he knows that around here there is no room for naivete.
Years ago, you had GM, Ford, and Chrysler. We had no competitors. We didn't have, Hyundai and all of them here. you have people that were fat and happy and thinking that nothing would ever happen to GM because it's such a large corporation.
In the old days, those words,
fat and happy,
would have been an odd choice for a union guy to use in talking about workers. But lately, union and company leaders are finding themselves on the same side of the table more often than not. That was especially true a few years back when everything in the U.S. auto industry came to a head. Foreign competition, recession, high oil prices, and an antiquated lineup of gas guzzlers.
It was a perfect storm.
And it brought GM to its knees.
The big three U.S. automakers plead with Congress, a desperate pitch to save them from financial ruin.
Much has been made of the car company CEO showing up for the congressional hearings in private jets.
It's Saturday Night Live.
Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before we begin, I'd like to apologize to the committee for the fact that we arrived here in Washington so late. As many of you know, instead of flying, the three of us decided to drive here from Detroit. But we had car trouble.
My name is Joe Frontera. I've been with General Motors I'm into my 37th year.
During those dark days of 2008, the late-night TV audience may have been laughing, but Frontera, a team leader here, most definitely was not.
I was working over in Plant One at that time, and one of the few still to be working. You could feel it, you know, not many people around, nothing really happening other than everybody having their fingers crossed.
Then in June 2009, General Motors filed for bankruptcy. The government stepped in with a $50 billion bailout. The auto workers union made some major concessions. 1 month later, GM emerged a new and streamlined company. As part of the reorganization, GM shed 20,000 U.S. jobs and shuttered several plants.
The Indianapolis GM stamping plant closed its doors for good today after 80 years in business.
This assembly plant in Pontiac, Michigan, is one of the factories that is now set for closure.
Tonawanda was lucky. The plant, which at its height in 1969 had employed 12,000 people, was now down to just shy of 800. But its doors stayed open. And then in 2010 came word from on high. Tonawanda would be awarded two new engine lines and an investment of almost $1 billion.
Once we got the word that we were going to be awarded the new engines, things really started to happen fast.
What happened next at the GM Tonawanda plant is a story of survival in this era of fierce global competition and success, but at a price. I'm Garrick Utley, and you're listening to New York and the World, a production of WRVO Public Media. Also still to come, New York City's blue-collar past, and how to get the young and restless to stay upstate. All that after this break. I'm Garrick Utley, and this is New York and the World, Our Lives, Our Future, a production of WRVO Public Media. What is the price of surviving and prospering in today's global economy? The GM plant at Tonawanda, outside Buffalo, is one good example. Sissel Overgaard continues the story of the plant and the workers there.
Just 5 years ago, as General Motors sank into bankruptcy, the workforce at this plant in Tonawanda had plummeted to an all-time low of 800 people. Now, with two new engine lines in production, that number has more than doubled. As Joe Frontera leads me across the factory floor, machinery hums, radios blare, and electronic jingles direct team leaders like him to areas in need of help.
Talk about bells and whistles, we have bells and whistles, right?
But there's a catch. The reason GM can afford to hire workers is because pay has gone down. A critical agreement between GM and the United Auto Workers in 2007 for the first time established a two-tier wage system, under which many new hires now get about half of what older workers earn for the same jobs, about $16 an hour versus $29. You might wonder what that would do to morale.
That particular issue is still developing, but we're starting to see the Tier 2s slowly being integrated with the rest of us. So it gets you thinking about, hey, why have me here if you can have this employee doing just as good a job or better than me and making half what I'm making?
When you look at all of the positives and the benefits and the upside, it's tremendous.
Steve Finch is the plant manager at Tonawanda.
We're insourcing work. We're growing our ranks. We're bringing more people in. Yes, they pay less than what the traditional employee would have gotten before. They're still a good paying job, still a very good job.
$16 is far above minimum wage, and union officials hope that with GM back to profitability, that number will go up. Finch adds that with more competitive wages, GM is not only re-importing jobs, but exporting more product.
For instance, one of our engines gets shipped over to China to go into vehicles over there. I think people should realize that it's not always, you know, the foreign manufacturers coming into the U.S. We're starting to do more and more where it's going the other way, too.
All in all, there's surprisingly little hand-wringing, at least in public, about the new realities of manufacturing. And shop chair Bob Coleman says what a family used to do on one salary now takes two. That's just how it is.
We have to be competitive with the foreign companies, or we're not going to have the work here. And nobody wants to see a huge drop in pay like that. But we also see with the competitors, it's a change. It's a huge change. And people see that. So they welcome any kind of job out there today.
The truth of that statement is evident every time Tonawanda hangs out its help wanted sign and the applications stream in. As for his own kids, Coleman's family legacy with GM seems likely to end with him. His oldest is going into nursing.
The GM plant in Tonawanda marks its 75th anniversary in 2013, a happy commemoration. But no one there can forget the price of success or merely survival. 12,000 workers in 1969, today fewer than 2,000. And then there is the other end of the Empire State.
New York, a wonderful town. The Bronx is up and the battery's down. The people ride in a hole in the ground. New York, New York, it's a wonderful town.
New York City, crowded, noisy, ever-changing. It, too, was once a major manufacturing center. In 1950, the garment industry employed 300,000 workers.
We're making mainly, as you can see, apparel. And then I think 80% of our products, those are bottoms. And then about 10% we have dresses and also jackets.
Ida Law, born in Hong Kong, is a sales manager at High Production Company on West 35th Street in Manhattan. A small company in a loft-style space. About 20 women are working here. Most of them came from China. Most are paid by piece. There used to be an enormous garment or apparel industry in New York City. It disappeared, most of it. Jobs went to Asia, to India, to Bangladesh.
95.5. Used to be 95% in the 70s being produced here in the United States. Now it's only 5% remain in the United States.
The garment industry and its jobs disappeared. But the story of what happened then is dramatically different from cities elsewhere in the state. The sounds of Fashion Week in New York City. It attracts nearly a 250,000 visitors from around the world. It has an economic impact on the city of more than $750 million. How did this happen? From the remains and memory of the city's garment industry and hundreds of thousands of jobs lost, arose something new, a designer fashion industry with high-skill, higher-paying jobs. Today, New York City is a global fashion center. And it's a textbook example of the advantages of a large city that can draw talent, launch businesses, and build a global industry.
I grew up in Youngstown, Ohio. I was the granddaughter of a bricklayer, and on the Irish side of the family, a carpenter.
Nanette Lepore and her husband left Youngstown, Ohio, and came to New York City in 1982. She wanted to work with a big-name designer. When that didn't work out, she became her own designer and started her own brand in Lower Manhattan, not far from where the Dutch had launched their first businesses more than 300 years earlier.
And we found a storefront on First Street between First and Second, between a gas station and a soup kitchen. And the rent was $500 a month. So when I didn't get the Ralph Lauren job, we signed the lease and we started a business.
And what is the business today? Where are you as a business today?
We're an international brand, and we have a retail volume of around 50 to 70 million.
Robert Savage, Nanette's husband and CEO of the company, recalls the day he approached a bank manager about getting money to open shop in the then emerging East Village.
He said, well, no one's going to loan you $5,000 to do that. He said, does your kitchen need to be renovated at all? And I said, yes. I have a Bunsen burner for a kitchen. So he said, well, we'll write it up as a home improvement loan. So that's how we got the first $5,000 to open the door.
The growth of the new designer fashion industry began in the 1970s with an insight and an idea. The future would belong to the creation of brands, designer names catering to the mass market of consumer aspirations. And so today we know the names and the brands of Calvin Klein, Donna Karan, Tommy Hilfiger, and many others. But like any industry, designer fashion depends on skilled workers, a pool of talent constantly fed by students who come out of good schools, such as FIT, the Fashion Institute of Technology, part of SUNY.
I think you need to come down an inch.
Okay.
I think it just
Jerry DeLova teaches at FIT. Here he's working with seniors on their final design projects.
I try and teach my students to have what I call a critical eye.
What draws the talent, the students from around the nation and from around the world to New York?
New York, there's a bustling feeling here that the kids like, and I think the energy brings them here. Also, it's a place where dreams are made. I mean, you know all those songs that talk about it, and I think everybody who comes to New York is a dreamer.
I've been to Milan and Paris and Spain.
FIT senior Lynn Choi from Chicago.
And I feel like New York has more like cultural differences and more influences from different places.
There's better opportunity for young designers here?
Yes.
In Europe?
Yeah. New York, you can intern at like the top design houses and you can get all this experience learning from different designers.
I think it's just so resourceful here.
Miguel Pena, a senior from California, emphasizes another key advantage of a large global city.
You can basically find anything you need start to finish, including factories or mills or people who dye things for you, all in like a range of 5 or 6 blocks.
It takes more than design talent from a Ralph Lauren or one day from a Lynn Choi or Miguel Pena to build and sustain a fashion company. FIT faculty member Jerry DeLova knows what that is, and he teaches it.
It's all about business. It's all about business.
Being a career-driven school and having industry professionals as members of our faculty, we have a very fluid curriculum.
Joanne Arbuckle is dean of the School of Art and Design.
And so our curriculum moves with the needs of the industry, with where we project the industry is going, and that creates a very different college graduate.
And one of those graduates is Michelle Sweet.
I did a year of my liberal arts at Hudson Valley Community College in Troy, and then I transferred here into the one-year program, and then now I'm on to my bachelor's.
Michelle Sweet is from Skodak, New York, one of many New Yorkers and young people anywhere who move to where they see opportunity and a way to fulfill their dreams.
I just feel like there's so much energy in New York and there's so many different people and cultures that come to New York that there's so much inspiration and everything around that you can see and experience.
Look at New York State as a big board with lots of marbles on it. Many of those marbles, people like Michelle Sweet, are rolling into the lower right-hand corner of the board, New York City and its metro region. Or they're rolling off the board and going out of state.
Most of the upstate cities that we looked at have lost at least 25% of their population over the last 30 years.
Again, Jonathan Bowles, who led the study on New York and the world.
From 1970 to 2010, the population declined by 44% in Buffalo, by 32% in Utica, 29% in Rochester, 26% in Syracuse, and 26% in Binghamton.
And that's a message that has been sent.
People are voting with their feet, and many of the people that are leaving are young people, people with talent, with higher education. These are people that potentially have entrepreneurial spirit, and upstate economies are having to make do without these very talented individuals.
And here we come to the heart of the matter, an issue much larger than the Empire State. As people vote with their feet, it's the expanding urban centers that are winning out. Consider that in New York City, 37% of residents are foreign-born. People provide talent. There are more than 8 million people in and around the city, from restaurant busboys to hedge fund managers to Nobel laureate scientists. They form a pool of talent whose breadth and depth is unrivaled in the world. And then there is money, investment, and the sound of Wall Street's opening bell. In a city like New York, money follows talent just as talent follows money and opportunity. They all come together to form a virtuous circle of growth in the 21st century economy. That is, growth and prosperity for many. Despite its successes, New York City has higher unemployment than the nation's average. Manhattan may have the highest median per capita income of any urban county in the United States, but neighboring Bronx has the lowest. The city is a place of extremes as well as dreams. Stand here in the middle of Manhattan at the corner of Madison Avenue and 57th Street, and you understand the old real estate saying, location, location, location. Look west down 57th Street and across from Carnegie Hall. A tower is rising. Price at the top for an apartment, $80 million. Take a few steps down Madison to the corner of 56th Street. There stands the Sony building, sold to a private developer who's going to turn it into condos. We can only guess the price. Look east on 56th Street at Park Avenue. A 90-story building is going up with condominium apartments. Price is no doubt as high as the 90th story. And here at the corner of Madison and 56th Street, we walk into a large public atrium with trees and chirping birds to meet with Barbara Fox, a veteran real estate broker. Who are these people and why are they spending this amount of money here?
Relatively speaking, our economy is much safer than a lot of the economies in these nations like China and Russia. And in South America, we're getting a lot of South American money coming in. And then there's always the Americans, the New Yorkers, the financial people who are making tons of money right now, great hedge fund money coming into the city and staying in the city, and that's who's spending the money and spending the tens of millions of dollars. And New York really doesn't have a lot of opportunity for housing for the true middle class. It can be brutal, and the so-called middle class is who is most affected by this.
Today, a young person comes out of college from Buffalo, Utica, Los Angeles, Chicago, comes to New York City. What does he or she face to be able to live in the place they want to live?
What kids are having to do at this point is take apartments with other kids to be able to afford it. The average two-bedroom apartment downtown is about $4,500 a month now. So if four people share it, they put up a couple of walls, and that's how they live. It's almost like dorm rooms.
Crowded up above and crowded down below. When someone disappears, you never even know. When it's hard times from the country, living down in New York town. It's a mighty long ways from the...
But despite the excitement of the big city, not all 20-somethings want to live like sardines packed into urban dorm rooms. There are young people who do move to New York City only to discover, sometimes to their own surprise, that success and a good future can be found elsewhere. Sometimes, back home.
To put it in perspective, I didn't think I was coming back. I lived in Montreal, London, Boston, New York. I really did not foresee coming back to Western New York.
But come home, Robert Anstey has. He's 32, born in Buffalo. Now he and his partners are building the tech company in Rochester.
When I lived in New York City, it took an hour and a half to get to work. You have all these standards of living that people sort of forget, how easy it was to get around, the cost of living.
But what really brought Robert Anstey back to Western New York was more than a good commute. It was an opportunity to build a business, along with his three partners, all of whom once worked for Kodak.
Right now, we're focused predominantly on the printed electronics industry, conductive inks and conductive pathways for smart packaging, anti-theft, and advanced electronics.
We met Robert Anstey and other small tech business entrepreneurs at a fair sponsored by High Tech Rochester. It was held at the Eastman Business Park.
These are all the resources that are here. There's also coffee.
Once, this was the sprawling manufacturing heart of the Eastman Kodak Company, 1,200 acres in the city. Listen. Do you recognize the sound? It's the Kodak Instamatic camera, which was launched 50 years ago, a global success. Rochester has long been home to other leading technology companies such as Bausch & Lomb and Xerox. But Kodak was the heart, and it was the soul of the city, the main engine of its prosperity, and the symbol of its pride.
This is his sort of party room. He could remove the furniture and the rug and set up for dancing.
George Eastman grew up in Rochester. In 1905, he built a 50-room home in the city where he lived in splendor with his mother. He never married.
And then this here is the dining room, all set up for like a family dinner.
Today, the house is a museum. Kathy Connor is the curator of the George Eastman legacy.
As the company expanded, he needed to be able to recruit highly educated people from some big cities like Boston, New York, Philadelphia. And so he started to work on making Rochester a better place to live and work and raise a family. Many of the things we had back then couldn't compete with the large cities. And so he began to invest some money of his own in educational institutions, also many of the hospitals, the Eastman Theater and the Eastman School of Music, so you could have quality caliber musicians and concerts and plays performed here in our community.
Eastman, debilitated by a painful condition, committed suicide in 1932. But Kodak continued to prosper. By the early 1980s, 60,000 people worked for the company. And then the once dominant global brand in film, packed in those familiar yellow boxes, missed the digital bus big time. The company sank into bankruptcy. It sold off many of its product lines and patents, even sold its own name, Kodak, to a company that will now put it on its digital cameras. As it emerges from bankruptcy, Kodak will be a much smaller company focused on commercial imaging. With much more space than it can use, it's offering facilities and support for new small businesses to grow. But will they ever be able to employ the number of people Kodak once did? We'll have more on that in a moment. I'm Garrick Utley, and this is New York in the World, a production of WRVO Public Media. You're listening to New York in the World, a production of WRVO Public Media. I'm Garrick Utley. No state in the nation has benefited as much and suffered as much from today's global economy as has New York. From Wall Street wealth to the decline of old manufacturing industries and cities. And yet, across the state, there are examples of innovation and growth. We've been looking at Rochester, where Kodak once provided jobs, security, and a good life.
If Kodak made enough film to go around the moon and back 10 times, then there's no reason we can't use the same infrastructure to really bring on the smart grid and advanced transportation and advanced energy storage.
That is entrepreneur Robert Anstey's vision of the future of his small company at the Eastman Business Park. Today, Rochester's vision of its future is built on new technologies, just as it was in its glorious past. So here's the question. Could Rochester ever become a mini New York City or even a mini Silicon Valley? And again, attracting that critical mass of talent and investment?
Well, I think from an asset standpoint, one of the most powerful things for the region is the quality of the workforce.
Mark Peterson, head of Greater Rochester Enterprise, knows the strengths and the obstacles to reviving the economy in and around Rochester.
With, 18 colleges and universities, including two major research universities, the University of Rochester and Rochester Institute of Technology, we have a workforce that is really able to respond to the needs of high-tech businesses that are being recruited to the region and that are growing in the region.
Take Doug Singer. He worked at Kodak for 17 years until his department was closed down in 2007. Now, like many other former Kodak employees, he's helping to build a new startup, Surion, that produces nano-sized chemical products.
We are very rich on ideas and innovation for products that are excellent. But as a small company, we have to figure out the best way and the smartest way to get our small amount of resources out into the world.
Size counts. And so does money, investment to build a new company. Again, Mark Peterson of Greater Rochester Enterprise.
Venture funding is not an easy play in the upstate market, certainly in the Greater Rochester region, even though we produce a high percentage of patents per capita, even though there's a huge amount of intellectual property here to invest in, very often we struggle to have companies get that A round of funding that is needed to have them really grow and prosper.
Like any city in New York State, Rochester needs more than skilled workers and investment dollars. It needs jobs. And here we come face to human face with a basic dilemma for New York and the nation. Many of the businesses of today and the future do not need as many workers as the high employment industries of the past. Remember the GM plant at Tonawanda, 12,000 employees in 1969, a fraction of that today. Kodak, 60,000 workers in the 1980s, 3,000 today.
The jobs in the past that took hundreds and hundreds of people, those aren't the types of jobs that are coming back.
Mike Ault is head of the Eastman Business Park.
The new manufacturing facilities tend to be high-tech, highly automated, utilizing a lot less people, but those people need to be very well trained. And so in the past where somebody maybe had a facility that had 300 or 400 people, that could typically be run with 100 people now. But they will still be making high-tech products, and those will be good wages.
The vision and indeed the importance of a high-tech future can be seen in the nanotechnology sector that has grown in and around Albany. It has taken massive investment from business and the state to get it launched. Now, the nano sector is spreading to the Rochester region with new facilities. That's the good news. And then there is the other side of the Rochester story.
I mean, we have more concentrated poverty than we've ever had. There are more neighborhoods that where the unemployment rate is rising. Performance of schools is getting worse. And there's still way too much crime.
Bill Johnson came to Rochester in 1972 to head the local office of the Urban League and to make Rochester his home. Later, he served three terms as the city's mayor, then joined the faculty of the Rochester Institute of Technology. His view of the future?
Yes, we do have these new companies coming aboard. They are creating, you know, 5, 10, 20 jobs, which doesn't even come close to matching the need. We're training students to come up with new technologies that will actually displace more and more people. I mean, in the name of progress, that is wonderful, but then you have to ask yourself, ultimately, how do we intend to support all these people? You know, I know the question, I just don't know the answer.
Part of the answer is certainly education and skills. Mark Peterson of Greater Rochester Enterprise.
On the one hand, you have stubborn unemployment. On the other hand, you have some companies right here in our own region that have hundreds of jobs available right now that if they could train the workers or had trained workers to be able to take those jobs, they could grow further than where they are right now.
And what does former Mayor Johnson see ahead?
We do see progress. We see these companies. They are turning out products. They're taking products to the marketplace. And yet, very few people directly benefit in terms of employment. I don't see any reversal of that trend. I wish I did.
Trends can be tricky things. Sometimes they can be downward. Sometimes they can turn upwards. Take one of the oldest manufacturing industries in New York, older than the railroads or the steel mills, the manufacturing of food and drink. Cecil Overgaard explains.
Back in the 1930s, Finger Lakes resident Carl Mortensen never could have imagined that one day the lakeside houses around here might sell for $500,000 or more.
When I was a little kid, nobody wanted lake property much because you couldn't grow any corn down there, you know.
In those days, agriculture reigned supreme, and it was the land, not the water, that served as his small town's link to the rest of the state.
New York City was full of horses. They used horses for everything. And our big thing then was to put up oat straw and hay and like that and ship it to New York City.
What happened next is a story that's been told so many times it hardly needs repeating. A gradual disappearance of farms and farmland. To urban development, to the allure of white-collar jobs, to mechanization and global pressure that made it hard for all but the biggest and most high-tech farms to compete. These days, many of those big New York farms are doing very well, but this is a story from the other end of the spectrum.
Oh, I got one right here.
On any given Saturday, you might find Tina DeGraff picking out produce at the farmer's market in Manhattan's Union Square, but it's not for eating.
I'm in food styling, magazines, commercials, things like that. So we do, when we can, we come to the market to get really beautiful things. Yeah. You got to make a pretty picture, right?
Today she's here to snag the most glamorous mushrooms she can find, destined for the pages of Oprah magazine.
And $17.50 right now.
DeGraff says the quality of the produce here is top-notch, but there's another reason she comes.
It's always best to shop local. I think that's the best way to shop.
That sentiment can't really be called new anymore, but as consumers continue to hop on the local food bandwagon, the financial benefits for farmers are real.
Mark Breckenridge, I work for Norwich Meadows Farm in Norwich, New York. I've been with Norwich Meadows Farm for 8 years now, and every year it gets bigger.
The farm itself gets bigger, and its customer base gets bigger.
And we had the markets, and we had the CSAs.
That's community-supported agriculture.
Many CSAs through Manhattan here, Queens, Brooklyn, Bronx. Tuesdays and Wednesdays are our CSA days, and there's, you know, 5-6 stops each day.
Anecdotal information like this is helpful when it comes to farm statistics because the data itself is always outdated. The last big agriculture census dates back to 2007, and the next one won't be released until early 2014.
And with the changes that are occurring in the agricultural industry right now, that's a lot of time.
But as New York's former commissioner of agriculture and someone who works with farmers, big and small, every day, Nathan Rudgers seems particularly qualified for gazing into the crystal ball. Here's what he sees.
What we're going to find is a significant stabilization in the number of farms, a significant increase in the number of new small farms, and an increase in the amount of land in farms.
Rudgers says a lot of that is thanks to the rise of the middle class in places like China. More money to spend usually means more interest in animal protein, which is good news for New York, a state where dairy accounts for more than half of the $5 billion agriculture industry. But, he says, there's also that growing interest in eating local.
What consumers are really looking for is someone who puts a human face on the food that they're consuming, and who has responsibility and accountability for the quality and the safety of that food.
Few people could provide a more jovial face than Anthony Road winery owner John Martini, who's been making the five-hour trip from Seneca Lake to Union Square Market for 18 years.
I come down here, the money's good and the show is great. You see things that you don't see at home. You see footwear that you can't believe people actually make, sell, and somebody wants to buy it. You know?
Martini says that sense of ethnographic wonder goes both ways, as most people here still don't really know where the Finger Lakes region is.
Now I bring the map and I point it out and they go, my God, you live in Canada. Isn't it too cold up there?
But in the last 18 years, there has been one very important change.
In the beginning, for the wine, people would walk by and I could hear them say, oh, New York wine, in falling tones, you know, like, oh, it's sweet and fruity and blah, 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 blah. We don't get that anymore. There's a recognition that New York wines are much better than they were. And so now we hear, oh, New York wine in rising tones. And I love Riesling. Well, I think 5 years ago, they probably didn't know what Riesling was.
I like to call it the 30-year overnight success.
Jim Treeseis heads the New York Wine and Grape Foundation.
The number of wineries has just mushroomed in the past 10 years in particular. There are now 335 wineries, and over two-thirds of those, so 200, have been created in the past 10 years.
About 40 of those wineries are here, participating in this year's second annual New York Drinks New York event at Astor Center.
Residual. If you look on the IRF scale here, somewhere right in the middle.
Restaurant and wine shop owners sip and spit in close quarters throughout the afternoon. The consumer tasting in the evening sold out weeks in advance. But lest you think this New York City buzz is simply a side effect of the buy local craze, Treeseis begs to differ.
If anything, it's the opposite. It's reverse discrimination. If it's local, it can't be good. You know, it's got to come from Europe or South America or some other place. And so we don't get a break, and we have to earn our way just like anybody else. And as they say, if you make it here, you make it anywhere. And we're making big progress.
For the last 3 years, Kevin Feindrick has been a part of that progress. As the owner of Upstate Wine Company, he's made it his personal goal to bring the metro region's attention to the wine in its own backyard, particularly wine from the Finger Lakes. And as far as he's concerned, it only gets better from here.
It can get as big as any other region. I mean, there's really nothing holding us back. We have the acreage. We have the quality. So, I mean, I can't really foresee an end in sight of where we're going to tap out here, but hopefully not for a while.
Hi there. Come on in.
Wine, local produce, even large-scale dairy exports may never get us back to the literal heydays of agriculture when horses filled the streets of New York City. But there sure are a lot of human mouths to feed around here, and that's all market opportunity.
We have been listening to voices of New York. Farmers, wine growers, assembly line workers, high-tech entrepreneurs, fashion designers, students. We hear their hopes, their dreams, their concerns, and challenges. There was Bob Coleman, the union shop steward at the GM plant in Tonawanda, where new workers are being hired, but at nearly half the pay he earns.
I mean, nobody wants to see a huge drop in pay like that, but we also see with the competitors, it's a change, it's a huge change, and people see that. So they welcome any kind of job out there today.
And there was Michelle Sweet from Skodak, New York, who dreams and sees a future in fashion design in New York City.
I just feel like there's so much energy in New York, and there's so many different people and cultures that come to New York, that there's so much inspiration and everything around that you can see and experience.
In Rochester, 32-year-old Robert Anstey returned home to create a high-tech company.
If Kodak made enough film to go around the moon and back 10 times, then there's no reason we can't use the same infrastructure to really bring on the smart grid and advanced transportation and advanced energy storage.
And then there is the voice of former Rochester Mayor Bill Johnson. He supports the efforts to create new jobs in new, highly skilled industries, but he does not see the numbers in this new economy adding up to the full employment, the good pay, and the job security of the past.
Because, yes, we do have these new companies coming aboard. They are creating, you know, 5, 10, 20 jobs, which doesn't even come close to matching the need. You know, I know the question. I just don't know the answer.
And so where do we go from here? From government programs to individual entrepreneurs to New Yorkers acquiring new skills, everyone is trying to figure out the answers. The SUNY Levin Institute's New York and the World report was prepared by the Center for an Urban Future, headed by Jonathan Bowles. He suggests some of the answers. There is entrepreneurship and the welcoming of immigrants.
We have found, especially in New York City, but in really across the country, that immigrants are a hugely positive force for economic growth. In New York City, they have kick-started economic growth. They are starting businesses at a very high rate. They have transformed once-depressed neighborhoods. There's so much power for this to happen in upstate cities as well. But when we did research across the state, when we had focus groups, we heard that a lot of upstate communities are very parochial, that haven't been that welcoming towards immigrants. I think that needs to change. I'm really heartened that Governor Cuomo and his administration have created an Office of New Americans that is trying to be welcoming towards immigrants and seeing the positive value of immigrants.
And then there is brain power. New York has it across the state.
Universities and academic research, you know, in today's global economy are critical assets, but too few of the technologies that are being discovered out of our universities are being developed into local companies. And so I think that it's the universities. They have a role. They have a responsibility to really be promoting innovation and entrepreneurship to a greater degree than they have been. The university presidents are aware of this, and I think we need to make sure we get more out of them and so that they actually become the local economic development catalyst that they can be.
Which brings us to the question, to what extent should New York communities look to state government for help or to themselves for self-help?
I think that there has to be a role for the state to play. But look, the state has tried to do this for 20 years. There's been a lot of different efforts, and most of them have not been working. We need to be making a challenge to our local communities to greatly increase the number of people who go into entrepreneurship. We should be challenging local communities to increase the percentage of their populations that have a 2 or 4 year degree by 10% over the next several years. We should be challenging the local communities to roll out the red carpet for immigrants and see a 5 or 10% increase in the coming years.
And does New York and its people have what it will take to get there?
You know, we did focus groups and town halls between the Center for an Urban Future and the SUNY Levin Institute around the state. I was really struck by the kind of optimism that still exists in a lot of places. And I think that in New York, we're starting to see a lot of local stakeholders get to that point where what's worked in the past is not going to work in the future, and we need to be doing something different. And I think we're starting to get there in New York, and I think that's really healthy.
In the end, it comes down to we, the people of New York, as well as Americans across the nation. How do we face and adapt to the forces of new technology, a global marketplace, and a changing society? Helping us to understand where we are and where we are headed is the role of New York in the world. You can find a link to this program and the individual stories within it, extended interviews, as well as the full New York in the World report on the website of this public radio station or at WRVO.org. New York in the World is a production of WRVO Public Media based on an original report commissioned by the SUNY Levin Institute. I'm Garrick Utley. We hope you'll keep in touch and get involved as we continue the conversation about New York in the world, our lives, our future.